Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hi, I'm John McEnroe.
I'm Bjorn Borg.
This is Martina Navratilova.
I'm Mats Wilander.
I'm Stan Wawrinka.
I'm Leighton Hewitt.
I'm Andy Murray.
This is Chris Savory, live from the Manga Club, and you're listening to the Tennis Podcast.
So that was Chris Savory, one of our Kickstarter backers, alongside his wife, Olivia, who won our Tennis Podcastaways competition and got a tennis holiday in La Manga Club as a result. Delighted they had a good time. If you go to our Instagram page, you'll be able to see pictures of them in their Tennis Podcast shirts at La Manga Club, about to illustrate their own Rafael Nadal-like left-handed forehands. How's your forehand at the moment, Catherine Whittaker, on this lovely rainy day in the UK? We've just seen a lovely week of tennis. Shanghai's just finished. Novak Djokovic has been amazing. But have you? Is your forehand all right?
Well, it's not left-handed. But might be a bit more effective if it were. I mean, I've still got the forehand constructed by La Manga Club this time last year, so I've stuck with my new grip.
Right.
It's not had a lot of outings recently. I played paddle tennis in the week. I've cheated on tennis. I don't know if it, because it's a form of tennis, I don't know whether it counts as cheating.
No, I'll let you have that. What is paddle tennis any good? Should people have a go?
Direct descendant. Do you know what? I was a bit cynical and sceptical because I'm a boring, cynical purist, and I absolutely loved it, really loved it. And it solves, I'm not saying it's better than tennis, but at the grassroots participation level, not the elite level, at the participation level, it solves a lot of the problems that you have with tennis. The best and the worst thing about tennis is how difficult it is. It is so difficult, and if you're no good at it, I don't think it's that fun to play tennis if you're rubbish, personally. I see people doing it and sometimes they look like they're having some fun, but whereas this, I mean, okay, I've got a bit of a background in tennis, but I'm no great shakes, and it's pretty different. And I picked up a paddle and I could do it, you know, and it was really, really accessible. Scoring system's the same as tennis. So from that perspective, you know, there's not a bunch of rules to learn or anything. It's quite kind on the body because it's sort of on an astro surface. I wasn't creaking in my joints afterwards.
Why is it easier?
Smaller court. I mean, it's just technically easier. You can... I don't know.
You're playing in a box though, right? Using a back fence.
You're playing in a box. It's kind of a hybrid of squash, tennis and badminton. You're playing with tennis balls in a box. You can play off the walls. That was something that I didn't master in any way, shape or form. Apparently, David, 10 million Spaniards are active paddle players. 10 million compared to 200,000 active tennis players.
Oh my goodness. That is shocking.
Look, I don't want it to take the place of tennis. I absolutely don't want that for a second. And I'm not sure it makes a brilliant spectator sport. But as a participation sport, I played in Guernsey, at the Guernsey Tennis Club, and I think that every single court was booked out the whole evening. There were people waiting to come on the court. We had to kick people off the court, and the tennis courts were empty.
Which current male and female tennis player would be the best at paddle tennis, in your opinion?
Oh, Well, I couldn't master the playing off the walls thing. It's so not instinctive for a tennis player. I imagine if you've played a lot of squash, you'd find that a lot easier to take to. But I just couldn't. I was just left sort of standing there gazing at the ball. I found myself volleying a lot, and I found that very effective. So maybe the better volleyers, but I don't know about that. I really don't. I mean, Stefan Edberg famously, he took up squash after he retired from tennis, didn't he? And he was like this vet's number one squash player, I believe, in Sweden.
Hmm.
So maybe somebody like Edberg played
right.
a bit of squash.
Well, maybe we can have a best of sort of five match at squash tennis. Paddle,
tops.
Racket,
the other thing
ball,
is, it might
tennis.
Be the one. It might be the one for you, David, because topspin isn't a thing
Hold
in
on.
Paddle tennis.
I can do topspin if I'm on my game. Do you mind?
All right, I've just not seen evidence of that with my own eyes.
That hurts. I did that good topspin into the ground just before the net, and then it bounced over
yeah.
like table tennis. So, anyway,
yeah,
enough of that. I don't really want to talk about my rematch with local pal Simon, because it went very similarly to the previous week, except I also had to stomach a bagel. But I did I did lead the second set 5-2 before, again, we're going to have a segment today on choking because we've got some more evidence of choking. And you've also been in touch with your submissions at Tennis Podcast for the biggest choke ever. Well, I've now gone consecutive weeks leading 5-2 double break, three times serving for a set, and both times failed. So,
It's because you're highly intelligent, David. That's what it is.
Thanks, Catherine.
According to Freakonomics, anyway.
Excellent. Appreciate that. Right, let's talk about tennis that's gone on this week in the real world, not in our pretend little tennis matches where I've got literally zero people watching at my club anyway. Shanghai has finished today. We come to you on a Sunday evening, a little earlier than normal this time on the Tennis Podcast, because Djokovic has already played and beaten Borna Coric 6-3, 6-4 to win the title. 18 match wins in a row. He's won three tournaments in a row, Cincinnati, US Open and Shanghai. I mean, he's getting better, Catherine. He's dominating the tennis world on the men's side again. And those three tournaments, of course, don't include the Wimbledon title that he also got shortly before. It is like we've just gone in a time warp back to 2015. He feels no different.
Yeah, it is absolutely like that sort of 2 year, 18 month hiatus just didn't happen. He's back into, I remember before the US Open saying, you know, I think he'll challenge, I think he'll win more Grand Slams, but I don't see him just relentlessly dominating in the way that he did. Well, that is not analysis that has aged well, because
fortunately,
that is precisely what he's doing.
Slightly unfortunately, there is an archive full of all of our cock-ups from the last 7 years.
There's no escaping from it. Yeah, I mean, I gave my arguments back then. I just didn't see that week in, week out, that invincibility shield surrounding him that he, I mean, as soon as you sort of clicked out of it, as soon as Djokovic became human again, it made us realise how extraordinary it was. And I just thought, I don't see how someone can capture that level of extraordinariness twice. And he's doing it, isn't he? He's doing it. I think he's probably favourite now to finish the year. Well, number one, he's taken the number two spot from Federer. He's 61-4 in China. He does love playing in China, doesn't he?
I don't actually, much as I like giving you a hard time, I don't even feel inclined to give you a hard time over that analysis back then, because A, I think I was saying pretty much the same thing, and B, just it is unlikely on paper to see somebody dominate that much, go through the sort of injury problem he had with an elbow injury that kept him out for 6 months, and to see a quite clear drop in motivation. That's the thing. That four things needed to happen for him to get to this position again. He first of all needed to get fully fit again. Second of all, he needed to find form. And if you remember earlier this year, in even after the surgery, he had a couple of months where he just didn't look like the same player whatsoever. He was losing to people he would never lose to before. So form was the second thing. The third Third one was just the sheer desire and willingness to put his body and life on the line to win tennis matches, to make that the thing that mattered the most to him. Because I don't care how good you are at this level, you can't just half-arse it. And he's had to put in the training and also be out there and be prepared to just do what it takes. And the fourth thing is the aura. That's what you need in order to properly dominate, isn't it? Because I don't think there is a player in the world that really thinks at the moment that if Djokovic plays at his best, that they're not comfortable against him. Nobody thinks, if I play my best, Djokovic is not going to be able to do anything about it.
No, well, I mean, Borna Coric was absolutely brilliant yesterday, and let's face it, took care of Roger Federer, at the time the world number two, now world number three, handily, and yet he walked on court today not really believing, I don't think, that he had a chance against Novak Djokovic. I mean, look, the matchup for him is horrible because he's like a Djokovic impersonator, isn't he, with his game. It's like Ferrer playing Nadal. Those matchups can be ugly. He played well, I thought, and still came up well short in the final. But he did as well as anyone did against Djokovic this week. I mean, he was barely challenged Djokovic, let's be honest. He was that good all week. I mean, the way he dismissed Sasha Zverev in the semi-finals,
yeah. Who
utterly
didn't play
dismissed
well,
him.
But still, there is also a reason why he didn't play well. I mean, okay, his serving maybe wasn't what it had been, but Djokovic puts pressure on you that other players don't.
Yeah. Oh, sorry, is that the end of the point?
That is as simple as I can put it, because, you know, remember when Evan Lendl was coaching Andy Murray and he said he used to look at Murray from behind in his returning position when he was standing at the back of the court, and he would look at how Murray shrinks the court for you as somebody trying to hit winners. Well, Djokovic does that even better, and he does it without muscling the ball. He times the ball he's such a clever tennis player. That's the other thing. He's not just a good ball striker and a good mover. He just is a nightmare to play against because he understands the geometry of the court so well.
He makes the opponent bail out of points in a way that they wouldn't usually. He makes them panic and just go, I have got no chance of winning a ping pong battle from the back of the court. I've got to make myself do things that don't feel comfortable to me, or put an extra 5% on my shots, or take myself out of my comfort zone. And frankly, only exceptional players can do that at a sustained level. And I say again, that is exactly what Borna Coric did to Roger Federer the day before. Federer was bailing out on points. You could see him panicking and going, goodness, I can't win this from the back. And, you know, he's kind of trying to bluff his way through it, Federer, it felt like. You know, Peter Fleming in the commentary on Sky said Federer's trying to win this with smoke and mirrors at the moment. And that's what it felt like.
And that's a trend this year, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. But look, Coric was brilliant, and there's no doubt he has gone up a gear in a very understated way this year. I mean, I didn't realise he had a serve like that on him that I saw from him this week. I didn't think the serve would ever be a huge weapon in his game the way it was this week. But unfortunately, as I say, the matchup for him against Djokovic is just, at the moment, a no-hoper.
I mean, I want to speak a little more on Coric before we move on. But first, just on Djokovic, he is, barring a miracle, I think he's going to end the year world number one. And whilst he's playing like this, and the way he's scheduling himself as well, I mean, he's playing a very clever game here. He's now worked it out. He's going to save himself for what matters in his view. And I know it's very easy to get carried away with these things and just take the current status quo and assume it will continue. But he's got the form. He's got the history of having had these sort of periods of utter domination, and it is hard to imagine where it will stop. I mean, I guess the obvious full stop is the clay court season when Rafael Nadal kicks into gear, because the assumption is that will happen, but it might not. I mean, Nadal has had injuries. Maybe he won't be able to get back to his best, and even if he does, if Djokovic plays like this, it's who beats the guy? How do you beat the guy?
Yeah, I mean, if it weren't for the fact that, you know, 2 years ago we were saying this, or 2.5 years ago we were saying this, and I just couldn't, I couldn't envisage, you know, what it would take to stop him, to stop his relentlessness. And things changed so quickly, you know, just in the space of a year. Look at where we were in men's tennis a year ago, and look how, you know, looking down our agenda today, we're about to talk about whether Federer's finished. You know, things change so much. So, yeah, I can't see it. I agree with you, I can't see it, but there's a lot, as is evidenced by a back catalogue, David, there's an awful lot of things that happen that we don't necessarily see coming.
No. So we'll just, you know, we'll couch it like that. Borna Coric, just more generally, is somebody, I mean, it was a surprise to me when I realised today that he's still only 21. Because he seems like he's been around for such a long time. I mean, the first time I ever saw him play was in 2013 in the Davis Cup against Great Britain. So I think he was 16 or 17 in Umag, and he played Andy Murray, and he inevitably got taught a bit of a lesson that day. But he then had some breakthrough wins. He beat Nadal, he beat Murray, but they felt like the sort of wins you get against one of the top players when they're just not at the top of their games. And then he sort of plateaued, and I remember him playing against Nick Kyrgios in, I think, one of the summer events in the States, and Kyrgios was really disrespectful of his game in a sort of overtly uncomfortable way, just in as much as he just felt like he shouldn't even be on the same court as him, and Kyrgios wiped the floor with him. And at that stage, you'd look at Coric and you'd think, well, where does progress come from here? He's 50 in the world. He plays well, but how does he ever hurt anybody with this sort of metronomic game without any real weapon and a slightly dodgy forehand? Well, that's changed, because he is hitting the ball so powerfully all the time. And the biggest comparison I could make to it, and this is really going back, but I remember watching Mary Jo Fernandez play tennis, who was somebody who also had a very strong, consistent game but couldn't hurt top players. And then she suddenly found a way to hit her forehand that started to hurt the very best players in the world. And I just find it really interesting to see somebody work on their game to that degree. He's got a different coaching setup these days, Coric, in his coaching team as well is it Riccardo Piatti, isn't it, who's part, yes, of the coaching team as well. It's not, yes, his only coach, but
I think that's had a big impact. I remember seeing him at our Amazon Prime Studios at the US Open, backed onto the practice courts, and I saw a figure on the far practice court from us, so five courts away, and I was so impressed with how he was hitting the ball, and I thought, I can't that must be one of the top players, but I can't make out who it is. And it really took me a while to realise that was Borna Coric, because I didn't associate the strike on the ball that I was seeing with Borna Coric. He had beefed things up, and I was keeping half an eye on him the whole time. I think he lost out third round in the end, did Coric, at the US Open. But I said to Greg, is that after my far too many moments of wondering before the penny dropped, so is that Borna Coric? And Greg commented on the difference he thought that Piatti was making and everything. So he's definitely beefed up his game. He's never going to be one of the, you know, never going to associate him with like Hulk like strength, are you? But yeah, in the midst of all these guys that are having a huge fanfare made around them, he's just slowly and steadily rising up the rankings. And he seems like a very smart guy, quite a serious guy. I think it's fair to say. I don't think he's in the lads gang, is he?
No.
You know, the next gen. Yeah, I think he's in a very different way to Tsitsipas. I think he's got a bit of Tsitsipas about him, in that he doesn't mind doing his own thing,
no,
being his own man. He's an interesting character.
I like his,
he's got fuzzy hair like Djokovic as well.
He does, but I like the fact that he's just carried on plugging away, and you know, he could have gone awry. He would have earned good money and all the rest of it, but he obviously really wants it, and he's gone back and he's made more of his career than he was making of it. And I've got a lot of respect for that.
He's 21, David.
I know, but you know what I mean. It's very easy to just get disillusioned, I think, or to rest on your laurels a bit and think, well, you know, I may as well just stick around here, work like I am, and 50 in the world, good living, all the rest of it. He's obviously got a lot that he wants to achieve in the world and in the career of tennis. So good for him, and well done, born at Chorich. Incidentally, we will get on to talking about Roger Federer and Alexander Zverev in a moment, but news hot off the press as I come to you here is that a press release has just been released to say that medical studies carried out on Saturday showed that Juan Martín Del Potro suffered a fracture of his right patella bone in Shanghai. It's a very difficult moment for me, he said. I feel very sad. It's a hard blow that leaves me without strength. It's very difficult for me to think about recovery again. I did not expect this to happen, said. I love this. The official press release said Delpo, who is wearing a splint on his right leg. In the coming days, the doctors will evaluate the recovery process needed to return to the court. I mean, he ain't playing the O2 with a fractured right patella bone. I can't imagine.
No, all I can think, trying to clutch at straws of positivity here, is that, okay, it'll be, I mean, I can't imagine he'll be able to do any physical activity at all with that upper body, I suppose. But in terms of the long term, a bone fracture is probably better than something muscular, something skeletal. I don't know. I'm speaking beyond my brief in the medical zone, as I sometimes do in this podcast. But do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
You know, once it's healed, it should be all right.
Sounds awful.
Obviously, in the short to medium term, awful and very painful, I'd imagine. I'm clutching, David. I'm clutching because that is just. Oh,
nasty,
yeah.
Nasty. Just did he
do, did he
so
do
well.
Something awful in a previous life?
Well, I mean, look, it's an awful shame if he can't play the O2 because he worked very hard to qualify for it. It's 10 years ago when he first qualified for it. But at the same time, if he can take the time out, what is it, 2-3 months now until the new season, and probably get right for Australia, then so be it. You know, don't want to see him miss this. But
yeah.
You know,
I mean, he missed Australia this year, let's remember.
Yeah.
Oh, you know, it's been ages since he's been to Australia. Yeah.
How miserable. How miserable.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term medical plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term medical plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
You mentioned Roger Federer and said we're going to talk about whether he's going to give up tennis. I've caused a bit of an argument and some feedback on Twitter by just, I don't know what made me think of it. I just started to think last night, I wonder what the tipping point will be for him eventually deciding to call it a day. And stupidly, I put that out on Twitter, and I've had about 90 replies so far, half of which seem to be that, how dare I even bring this up at a moment when he's just suffered a loss? I mean, what that's got to do with it, I don't know. I mean, from my vantage point, it's just a conversation point, and I'm curious to know, because believe it or not, one day he won't play tennis, because that's called getting old. He's defied Father Time for an incredible amount of time, and he may well still have a lot more left in him. But I was just curious as to, you know, there have been some losses this year. There have been some performances that have made you think he doesn't quite look like he did a year ago, and certainly at the start of this year. And I wonder whether it'll be disappointments like that, or whether it will be something more pre-planned in his mind that he's aiming for. But anyway, his record from the Australian Open at the start of last year to Indian Wells of this year was 69 wins and 6 losses. But since Miami of this year, he's won 22 matches and lost 6 matches. So it's a pretty severe fall away of form. I mean, you know, you're not going to match what he did necessarily of 69 and 6, but still, what are your thoughts?
I think let's not fall into the trap of predicting Federer's demise like we did in 2015, not for the first time, just off the back of a run of few results. You know, Wolf has been cried before. However, you know, one of these times it has to be for real. We know that he cannot go on forever. Yes, he has defied all laws of biology and physics for a long time, but he won't go on forever. I thought he looked really good against Nishikori, and I thought he was looking a lot better on the faster courts of Shanghai, and it reminded me just how much the slower courts of the US Open really didn't suit him. That was a real blow for Federer, I think, the slowing down of the courts. But then he was so far short against Chorich. He did look a step slow. I don't necessarily think that means he's lost a step, full stop, because he didn't look a step slow to me against Nishikori. So maybe it's just sort of end of year fatigue, you know, recovery time, but he was planting his foot on the backhand side just a tad late. Do you know what I mean? Or do I mean a tad early? Just that's always the giveaway. Look, it's been by Federer standards, it's been a bad run of results. I think that Anderson loss from 2 sets up at Wimbledon really, really shook him. I do. I think that, okay, I know there were a few not so great results before that. Hasn't won a title. He's been stuck on 99 titles. Was it 98 since Stuttgart? Everyone was forecasting, it's 98, isn't it? Because people were forecasting that Wimbledon could be his 100th if he had won Halle, where he, of course, lost to Chorich and then Wimbledon. But I think first the Chorich loss to a far lesser degree, but then I think that Kevin Anderson loss, he needs a bit of time off to properly reset from that, really, and put it. I don't think that's fully behind him yet. So we'll see.
At the same time, the time off thing, I also wonder whether that's now starting to work against him a little bit, because he's not winning as many matches, is he? So it's not quite the same as going and winning 2 tournaments and then having 5 weeks off and then winning 2 more. If you're not winning that many matches, then you're just basically not playing. So anyway, we'll find out, won't we, in the weeks and months to come, how Federer bounces back from this. He's due to play, I think he's due to play Paris indoors, isn't he? I don't know whether he is, actually.
I don't think he's fully confirmed his participation yet. Okay. Will he play Basel as well?
Basel he's playing, of course he is. That's surely right. He'll play that's, Basel, that's the next yeah. one he's playing. And then there is the O2, of course, at the end of the year. So it will be interesting, as it always is. The other player we've got on the agenda here to talk about is Alexander Zverev. Just very quickly, he sailed past a couple of the young guys. Alex de Minaur thrashed him, and then he eventually came up against Djokovic and he was thrashed himself 6-2, 6-1. He's qualified for the O2. Are you a glass half full or glass half empty person where it comes to Zverev at the moment?
I don't know where I am with Zverev. I don't know. I found his comments about... Did you see his comments about the O2 meaning as much, if not more, than a Grand Slam?
Yes.
Those perplexed me. Because first of all, I thought, you haven't won a Grand Slam, mate. You've not even got close. Who are you to say that? Sort of speaking on behalf of Grand Slam winners, saying most of the guys value it as much, if not more, than a Grand Slam. I first of all thought, not sure that's true. And second of all, even if that is anecdotally your experience, is it really your place to say? I just thought that made him look a bit silly, really. He doesn't know how winning a Grand Slam feels. And I don't know. Do you know what I mean? It just felt slightly off key, those comments. Of course, you're going to feel like qualifying for the O2 is huge. And it's a great achievement. But Are you really going to get to the end of your career and all you've done is qualify for the O2 every year and go, yeah, great, that's all I wanted to do, job done?
I dare say there is a bit of positive reinforcement in what he said there, that, you know, he's just, he doesn't want to dwell on these slams too much because, frankly, they don't make too pretty reading. So, I'm on the fence as well. I mean, look, I think overall I'd be glasses half full, in as much as I just cannot believe somebody this good who wins this often everywhere else isn't going to eventually just crack it at the slams, particularly with Ivan Lendl in his corner. But I tell you, 2019 feels to me like a massive year for Alexander Zverev.
I mean, if he's not done big things at the slams by the end of 2019, do you see Lendl sticking around in 2020? I know we've just made a whole thing of the fact that a year is a long time in tennis and you can't really predict anything, but
I'm not convinced.
I mean that he's not going to be there in 5 years slogging away with him if he's not sprinkled the magic dust.
I just think Lendl is going to want to see something from him over the next year. There's going to have to be some sort of breakthrough.
I think so too.
Really.
I mean, a final would probably be enough, but
maybe
a couple of semi-finals, maybe. I don't think quarterfinals are going to cut it.
Progress needs to be made. I mean, look, for many years, despite the fact that Djokovic won the Australian Open, he had a number of years then, what was it, 3 years really, until he actually broke through and won another one. And he reached a lot of latter stages and came up short. So,
yeah, he's not reaching the latter stages, though. He's coming up short against guys that he should beat. That's the issue.
I understand that, but if you look at his age, I mean, he's still, what is he, 21? So he's still very young too. But it's just, again, it feels like we've been having this conversation for too long now on the case of Alexander Zverev. Carl Edmund got to a quarterfinal. Decent performance from him. He was eventually beaten by Zverev as well. He could maybe get in towards the alternate spot for London, and obviously with Del Potro's injury now, that may become relevant at some point, but we'll wait and see. I thought it was a pretty good week for Edmund again, because he backed up last week's, what was it, semi-final in Beijing.
Yeah, decent week. Positive.
So elsewhere, anything else from Shanghai you want to say, Catherine, before we move on?
Well, there were all the comments about Davis Cup flying around and the fact that PK was there. But is that in a separate portion of the agenda?
I think we can go straight into that, personally.
So let's go straight there.
Yeah, because Stuart Fraser, our colleague from The Times, he was over in Shanghai and getting all the goss from the ground. And, yeah, basically everybody who came into press conference was asked about the Davis Cup. First of all, Roger Federer said, "I highly doubt that I'll be playing. We'll see what happens. I don't think it was designed for me anyhow," which is interesting. He thinks it was designed for the next generation. Alexander Zverev has said, "Making a tournament at the end of November is crazy. By the end of the year, we're all tired. It's not happening. And I guarantee you, well, I will not be the only one." We had Novak Djokovic saying, "I just feel the date of Davis Cup is really bad, especially for top players. Between the two, I will prioritise the World Team Cup because that's a competition of the ATP, of which he's now been voted, re-elected back onto as the head of the ATP Player Council." He said, "We'll have to obviously discuss with his own team, but that is already three of your biggest players basically saying that they're probably not going to play it, which is, it's quite upsetting, I think, to probably not surprising as well, given all we've heard to this point, the fact that they've got this tournament taking place in mid to late November of 2019. What I didn't realise, Catherine, was that actually the World Team Cup is due to take place from the 27th of December until the 5th of January. 5 weeks between the two. It is insane, to use that phrase.
To use Chris Cuomo's phrase. Yeah, I found it all really, really distressing, actually, all of those comments. I found Roger Federer's justification for probably not playing really disappointing and a cop-out, an absolute cop-out, really, to say this was designed for the future generation of players. He knows his power in tennis. He's well aware of it, and he uses it for great good a lot of the time. He knows the significance and the power of him committing, even just for 1 year, in its inaugural year, committing to play, the boost that would give it, and the message it would send to other players. He is more than aware of all of that. So for him to say, it's not really for me, you know, I find that really disappointing from Roger Federer.
Do you think it's fair enough, Catherine, if a player didn't believe in this whole upheaval in the first place, or if you were Leighton Hewitt or whoever it is, if you felt really strongly about it in the first place, do you think it's fair enough to say, well, because of all that, I'm not going to make myself available? It's a stand I'm going to take.
Federer didn't take that stand against the Davis Cup reforms.
Or if you've got, in his case as well, your own event.
None of the players that are speaking out took a stand against Davis Cup reforms. Did they? So I guess in principle, I mean, I've seen some people suggesting that it's wrong of GB to have accepted a wild card when they voted against the reforms. I personally don't share that view. I think that would be sort of cutting off their nose to spite their face.
Do you think
really,
it's fair enough to say I'm not going to play because it's just in a ridiculous time of the year? Or do you just think the Davis Cup is so important?
What, but
to
playing
the sport.
It at the end, playing it at the end of November.
Yeah,
but I don't see a lot of the big money exhibitions taking place. You know, for example, in Saudi Arabia on the 22nd of December. Nobody's commenting on what a ridiculous time of year they are. I mean,
not
if you're
the same though, is it? Having a hit and giggle.
No. Look, tell me a better time of year.
September.
I think that's a cop out. I think it's a cop out. If you want to play enough, you want to play. Look, the wider scheduling of tennis and the fact that the season is too long is a separate issue. It's not Davis Cup's fault that is the case, and they have to fit within an already stretched and overworked framework.
If you had it, though, in the place of the Labour Cup week.
You could say, oh, the Australian Open's at a terrible time of year because it falls too close to Davis Cup. Do you know what I mean? Like, why are you singling out Davis Cup as the one for criticism in terms of the schedule? Of course it's not ideal. Of course it's not. But I don't think the proposed scheduling of the World Team Cup or whatever it's going to be sounds particularly great either. I mean, isn't that when they're all in the Maldives?
Well, no, because they've pretty much finished their holidays and they're doing the first week of the tennis year, aren't they, from 1st of January?
I suppose
January.
So. Well, I don't know if Davis Cup were proposed to be in that end of December, beginning of January week, do you think they'd all be saying that's inconvenient as well? Probably. Mm. I just feel like it's a lazy excuse. If they were committed enough to it, and it's a self-fulfilling thing, if they commit to it, then others will commit to it, and it will become something significant and meaningful, or remain something significant and meaningful.
Don't you get it in a better part of the calendar if you raise objection at the outset like this and say, no, the problem is, though, that the sense
of... Well, is there the flexibility? But I don't feel like Djokovic saying, well, I'm going to play the ATP event rather than the Davis Cup event. That's not, trying to wield power to get it moved in the calendar, is it? That's just saying, I'm not that bothered.
He did also say, I hope they can work out a solution to combine the two. The only thing is, he's part of that negotiation. I mean, he is the head of the ATP Player Council, so he does wield some influence there, of course. And actually, as you say, he ended up meeting Gerard Piquet for half an hour, as reported by Stuart Fraser, straight after after one of his match wins. So, but he said it doesn't look like that's going to happen. We were all hoping a couple of weeks ago, weren't we, that something might happen. I suppose the one time a year you could have it is in Laver Cup week, which is where they've sort of identified where they'd like to have it. But they can't because there's a Laver Cup. And again, that just...
What a mess, David. Oh, what an absolute mess.
So frustrating. Right.
It's really... I mean, it might not end up being worst case scenario, but it's becoming increasingly difficult to see it being resolved in a really satisfactory way, isn't it?
I think they'll get there.
I think it's going to get there. I still think they'll get there,
but I just don't. I think they will get to a point where they combine both of these events. They're running out of time for next year. That's the problem. But I'm still hopeful because the current situation is so ridiculous that I cannot see how it can be sustainable. So surely that will lead to eventually the right conversations being had and decisions being made that will be.
What do you think about this exhibition in Saudi Arabia that Nadal and Djokovic are playing?
I think it's disappointing, to be honest, for a number of reasons. How much money do you need? Why are you going there? There's a heck of a lot at stake over there. I mean, it's not the only sporting event. There's so many sporting events being held over there at the moment. I mean, but you know, there's that journalist who's been reportedly has gone missing and is, you know, the concerns are that he's been murdered. I mean, this, you know, it's I'm not happy about it, really. No.
I mean, even if you didn't feel strongly about the there being that event and the players participating, it the timing of the announcement being just, was it the day after Jamal Khashoggi, the journalist that disappeared at the Saudi consulate, I think it was the day after or a couple of days after that they announced it. You know, it's just so tone deaf. And I know it's absolutely not black and white. You know, if we said that it, you know, you shouldn't be playing tennis in any country which has a dubious moral record, then you could end up cancelling an awful lot of American events at the moment. Do you know what I mean? Like, it's a sliding scale, isn't it? But the line has to be drawn somewhere. It has to be drawn somewhere. And surely, if you're drawing a line, it has to be drawn before Saudi Arabia, because in terms of human rights and the rest of it, let alone the very recent developments in the political climate. I mean, it's beyond the pale, isn't it? We're talking about a country where rape is legal. Do you know what I mean? Like, it's so beyond. But I'm very conscious that it's not a black and white situation. I mean, Qatar's moral track record and certainly their, in terms of sports, their human rights record with regards to the construction of the World Cup stadiums, I mean, that should be receiving an awful lot more attention, but we're all just sort of turning a blind eye to that. And tennis takes place happily in Qatar and we all talk about it and support it and that's all fine. I still don't think they're anywhere near as bad as Saudi Arabia, but, you know, it's not black and white. I get that. But it also doesn't feel right. No. Doesn't feel right.
No, incidentally... Let's talk about something slightly brighter in terms of the behaviour of tennis players. And there is a lot of good behaviour from tennis players generally and well-meaningness around there as well. Not a nice situation, but great pictures to have seen Rafael Nadal helping to clear the floodwaters and in the Majorcan town of San Lorenc, I think it is, where torrential rain has ravaged the area and killed 12 people. And he also offered to the use of the Rafael Nadal Academy sports centre to all the people affected so that they can have somewhere to go. I mean, that was a really nice thing to have done. And also notable, I thought that he was reluctant, from what I understand, for it to be publicised on one level, but also realised that by having pictures of him involved in the clear-up, it would get the attention that would help further. And I must say, I didn't know too much about it until I saw the pictures of him. So, you know, that is great to have seen that he's done that.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. He did look uncomfortable. It's not really his thing, is it? But absolutely, it was just, what more can be said? It was just a very good thing he did. Mm. Brilliant.
Good on you, Rafa. Now, should we talk about a bit of the tennis that's gone on elsewhere this week? In Hong Kong, a player, I must admit, I don't think I'd seen before Hong Kong this week, has won the title. Diana Yastremska, have I said that well, has beaten...
I think so. I mean, I'm no expert in the pronunciation of Diana Yastremska, nor anything else about her.
Talking of pronunciations, apparently I've been getting, not only we've been confusing Wang with Wong, which is the correct pronunciation of the player that's been just winning on a regular basis. It also should have been Chang rather than Qiang. So we've got that one wrong too. Anyway.
Chang Wong. Yes, Chang.
Exactly. Oh. She lost to Diana Yastremska, 6-2, 6-1 in the final there. Yastremska
hadn't read the script, had she?
No. Well, she hits a big ball from everything I'm hearing. I dare say Wong was struggling a bit physically after all the work she's put in. I mean, she beat Muguruza from a breakdown in the final set in the semi-final. So great run for her again. What a run she has had recently. But Yastremska, the champion in Hong Kong. Caroline Garcia won her first title of the year in Tianjin, beating Karolina Pliskova, a tournament at which Pliskova beat Katie Bolter of Britain in the quarterfinals. Good run for Bolter. She got a couple of really good wins, including one against Maria Sakkari, the world number 42. So that puts Bolter into the top 100 for the first time. Nice line as well to see Tamaya Bachinski back winning tennis matches. She got to the semi-finals in Tianjin, was in tears afterwards. She's had horrible injuries again, hand surgery included and all that. She just, you know how we said Kiki Bertens looks like the sort of player that you'd probably want to be mates with? I think Bachinski's another one, don't you?
Oh, yeah, I'm well up for being mates with Tamaya Bachinski. She's brilliant. Okay. Yeah, she's a very real person. If that makes sense. She's very human, very relatable. She's got that amazing story about how she'd retired from tennis. She was working in the hospitality industry. She was working in a hotel, I think, and she got the call to say, you've got into the qualifying draw for the French Open, you know, on your residual ranking. She just threw some tennis rackets in the back of a car and set off from Switzerland to Paris and qualified and I think she got to the fourth round, went on a run anyway. One of those, it's the old story of sort of having a real perspective on the sport after having had time away and then enforced time away with these injuries and surgery that she's had. It's been a real rocky road back for her. It was really emotional to see those tears, and also a marker of how big a deal it is these days to beat Sabalenka. Six months ago, it wouldn't be beating Sabalenka that would make you burst into tears and make you feel like, right, I'm back here. So it's a massive compliment to Aryna Sabalenka.
It was, yeah. Another little line as well here for Jack Draper, the 16-year-old British player who's won his third pro title in 5 weeks. He's only just turned pro by picking up the title in Lagos, the 25,000 event. I saw the last few points of that. He had 4 match points. Great crowd out for that final, and just a brilliant experience for him to have had, because it wasn't just winning the title, it was being put through the mill. He had one match point in which his opponent just made incredible number of retrievals and the crowd were going wild, and Draper still got the win. So quite exciting, isn't it, seeing the way he's going along? He's 400 and something in the world now.
Yeah, he's very un-British in his attitude, isn't he? He's very, you know, he's got a little bit of sort of American punky jock about him, which I think will serve him well. I think sometimes being British isn't necessarily the best of things in terms of becoming a professional athlete, certainly in individual sports, although our football team would suggest it's also an issue in team sports. But you know what I mean? Having that sort of, I don't care what people think of me, no stiff upper lip here vibe. That Indeed. Sort of thing. Yeah. You have, David, yes. You have tweeted while we've been recording this podcast.
Well, you know, I'm a multitasker.
Oh. Except you're really not a multitasker. I know you. You're a terrible multitasker.
I'm brilliant at multitasking. How dare you? What on earth makes you say that?
I've known you for 12 years. Every single moment of those 12 years makes me say that. I can't believe you've been tweeting.
Hold on a minute. You've been monitoring Twitter while we've been having the tennis podcast?
Just, well, when you said that the Del Post statement had come out, I just refreshed my feed just to make sure I was, you know, getting the facts straight. And I see that, oh, David Laws tweeted about it 22 minutes ago.
I just thought I'd stick that out there.
Unbelievable.
Well, there we are. You know, that, I'm just doing my bit. Now, Wimbledon are looking increasingly as if they're going to be able to expand, having made an offer to the Wimbledon Park Golf Club over the road, and more than 75% of the voters needed to say yes to a further ballot in order to consider this offer, and it does look like it'll go through. Now, if it does, it will, according to Simon Briggs, our Telegraph partners here on the Tennis Podcast, according to Simon, if this all happens, Wimbledon is likely to treble in space to, you know, expanding its current site, which
is
would there, be really
is,
something.
Is there such
it?
A thing as too big?
No. I mean,
that sounds like a long walk.
Yeah, all right. Well, okay. Too big for Catherine Whittaker's.
I mean, I know a big part of the plan is moving the qualifying to the area where the golf club would be. Or is now. And I love Wimbledon qualifying being off-site. I love
no.
it. I really, really love it. I know it's not great for journalists and everything, but Wimbledon qualifying Quaint. Is one of my favourite events of the year.
I get it, but it'd be better if
they
it
let
was
dogs
at
in. They let dogs in.
Well, we can still let them in to the bigger site. If it's three times as big, you can get more dogs in.
I'll eat my words if the newly expanded Wimbledon opens for qualifying in, what was it going to be, 2021?
Yeah.
And there are Labradors roaming the place.
And
we can go back in the archive, find this episode and replay it.
And there will be more, there'll be plenty of room for Kids Day, Catherine. So,
have they said they're going to
no.
hold a Kids Day?
But
right then.
I'm just saying.
If they say Dogs and Kids Day, then I'll get excited about it. Until then, I feel like... Phew, I don't know. I don't feel opposed to it. I just feel uninterested by it.
Well, yeah, but we need to grow in order to move on, don't we?
Do Come we? On. I mean, can we not grow the French Open?
Well, yeah, but
that is
so growing,
small.
Isn't it?
That is the one. That's the one that's hectic.
But that's expanding.
Not enough.
But it's going to expand big time.
Could they expand into the golf club across the road from Wimbledon?
More or less. That's basically what they're doing, isn't it? From what I understand.
Okay.
But anyway.
Not so, I mean, they take their time, the French, they.
Yes, well, they do. Wimbledon step on the gas and get it done. So anyway, that's the news there. Fed Cup draw's been made for, or at least the pre-draw for the February ties in Bath. And Britain will be in a group of four with Croatia or Hungary, Turkey or Greece and Georgia or Slovenia, if that makes sense. The Australian Open 2019 launch has happened. Prize money increase, you won't be surprised to know. 25-second shot clock on all main draw matches. Heat stress index to replace the extreme heat policy, although no actual detail of what the heat stress index is going to be yet. They'll continue
trying... It's going to be putting a phone call in to Catherine Whittaker and saying, are you stressed about the heat? And I'll say, yes, I am.
And then what?
And then they'll just cancel it all and say, go and lie by a pool, everyone.
Until about 8 o'clock tonight.
Yeah,
right.
Great.
Okay. That's how it works, everybody. Hot off the press here on the Tennis Podcast. Joe Konta and Michael Joyce are no longer a partnership, and Konta is now working on a trial basis, BBC Sport understands, with Dmitry Zavialov, who worked with Stan Wawrinka for 17 years. Perhaps not that big a surprise, because Stan Wawrinka has been represented by Starwing Sports, who are led by Lawrence Frankopan, an agent I know quite well. He's been with them for a long time. Contra has now started being represented by them as well. And that's often how these coaching assignments are made is, you know, I've had experience of him with one player and so you might as well give him a go, that kind of thing. But this would be her fourth coach in about 3 years because she had Esteban Carril, then Wim Fissette, then Michael Joyce, and now Dmitry Zavialov. So it's a lot of coaches, in fact, in just over 2 years.
Yeah, she needs one of these to work long term, really. I mean, let's be honest, it never worked with Michael Joyce, despite her protestations to the contrary. We knew, you know, she kept saying, oh, it's just a matter of time before it clicks. Everything on the practice court's great. But you could tell it wasn't, you know, their dynamic just wasn't right.
Why do you think that was? I mean, my sense is because he was trying to get her to do something different and he was trying to tell her
which
a little foreign to what she was used to.
Yeah, which I didn't necessarily think is the wrong thing. I just think she is opposed to that. I think she thinks, I've got my game. It's a very good game when it's on. If it's not on, I'm prepared to be beaten. But she's not particularly up for changing that game, is she?
But I think consciously she was, hence why she hired him. And I think she wanted to hear all the things that he said in a logical way. And then the moment that it was tense and she was actually going to have to put them into practice, I think she wanted to resort to what she knew, and he was not having that. And I think there was a discord, and it wasn't working. That's kind of how I see it, because I thought a lot about this. A lot of people saying that Conte needs to add more to a game, have a plan B, etc. I just sort of think, well, what's the point? I don't think she's going to be good enough to do that. I think she'd be better off absolutely maximising plan A and winning as often as she can with that, really.
Yeah, well, I think she agrees with you. And you could well be right, But, I mean, it's a lot of change for her, isn't it? No consistency, but pretty much all her team have gone. Whole new ensemble around her. So let's see. I mean, on the basis of the last year, that's no bad thing, is it, to have a bit of a fresh start, get a new puppy, get a new coach. First. I like her order of priority.
Puppy as assistant coach. That, you know, put the puppy on the side of the court. How could you not fail? How could you fail to be uplifted?
Absolutely.
Right, okay.
It's an underused tactic.
We haven't got time for worst tennis jokes, I'm afraid, on this edition of the Tennis Podcast. We're going to have to leave them for next week because there's lots to get through.
Oh, jokes. I thought you said jokes. I was like about to intervene and say that was never on my agenda and nor will it be.
I have got a good knock-knock joke, which was told to me by world number four.
No.
Right. Okay, Catherine, we'll talk about her worst tennis jokes next week on the show.
If you want to hear David's knock-knock joke, I'm quite sure he'll put it on Twitter in the next week, so don't worry.
I'll do a separate podcast without Catherine on it if you want. No? All right, fine.
David Catherine, does jokes.
Have a lovely week.
you too.
This has been a Tennis Podcast brought to you in association with The Telegraph, with executive producers Melanie Bowes, SSS, and TennisBalls.com, sponsored by La Manga Club, and we have enjoyed talking to you and to you, Catherine. We'll speak to you all next week.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.